is ESPN Chicago, WNVP, WTBC, HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago. Now here's your host, Connor McKnight.
Good afternoon and welcome into White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. Happy holidays, White Sox fans. Starting at just $66, get a White Sox holiday pack, redeemable for more than 50 games throughout the 2025 season. To learn more and to purchase, visit whitesox.com/holidaypacks. Well, welcome into the show, everybody. Glad to have you here this Saturday afternoon. Winter meetings coming up on Sunday, tomorrow. Obviously, a lot of trade rumor chatter, Juan Soto's whole thing. And there's a lot coming up for Major League Baseball here in the winter meetings by deadline. You've got the Rule 5 draft, the draft lottery, all kinds of good stuff that will feature the White Sox in one way or another. Also, there's this thing out there called the Golden At-Bat that Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred is pushing around a little bit, perhaps a trial balloon of sorts. We'll discuss that a little bit later on in the show as well. However, some sad news for the White Sox and the White Sox family came on Thursday, December 5th. Bill Melton, who played 10 seasons in the bigs, including 8 with the White Sox, passed away at the age of 79. He was at his home in Phoenix, passed away after a brief illness, is loved and remembered by White Sox fans throughout the decades for his role and his connection to the team. I don't often do this, but I do want to promote a couple of different things on this station and in other places as well. I knew Bill a little bit. I can tell you one story. It happened a couple of different times. Bill was such a joy to talk baseball with. He was of an era, you know, kind of that late 60s, early 70s that talks baseball a certain way. And for me, I'll just speak for myself, but for me, kind of a kid of the late 90s and 2000s, hearing somebody talk about baseball the way they used to in those decades is just such a cool thing. It's such an awesome way to connect with the decades past, and Bill made it such an easy way, made that connection so easy. There would be a couple of times in my broadcasting career I remember doing the pregame show or even very rarely a postgame show when Bill was at the at the ballpark, but not doing a postgame show. He'd be around late sometimes, rarely. I think this happened once. And then a couple of times during this show, White Sox Weekly, leading into games on Saturday. For those of you who have been up in the broadcast level, you know that we are lucky enough to have a booth up there from which we do the pre- and post-game show and White Sox Weekly, and the door closes. It's a soundproof booth. It needs to be. It's a radio studio. Bill didn't care a whole lot for the soundproofing of the booth or when anybody was on air. I guess maybe when I wasn't on air. And there were a couple of different times, God love him, where we'd be either doing White Sox Weekly or the pregame show would be going on, and Bill would just walk through the door and announce his presence with words that we can't use here on the show and start talking baseball right away. Connor, we got to talk, and just, kind of lead into it like that. And, if you were lucky enough to be listening a time or two when Bill crashed through the door, you heard him. I can't say that I knew Bill all that well, and I wish I knew him better, certainly. After retiring in 2020, after a long career as a pre- and post-game analyst working alongside Chuck Garfine, I know White Sox fans got to know him very well. He was in your living room through some great times in White Sox history, and his passion for the game, his passion for the team was something that was so easily recognizable, so very clear. And like a lot of former White Sox who we are, blessed to have on television, either analyzing the game or, just kind of tangentially around the ball club still, it's real. That kind of passion, that kind of connection to the game, to the franchise, it's very real. And with Bill, that was evident as anything else. White Sox chairman Jerry Reinsdorf released a statement, and I'll read in part a little bit of it here. And I've got a Bill Melton story, and we'll hear a little bit from Bill in 1971 in just a little bit, too. Here's the statement from Chairman Jerry Reinsdorf. Bill Melton enjoyed two tremendous careers with the White Sox. His first came as a celebrated home run king for White Sox teams in the early 1970s, where Belton Bill brought a power to a franchise that played its home games at a pitcher-friendly ballpark. Photos of Bill wearing his home run crown and others of him posing with ballpark organist Nancy Faust still generate smiles to this day. Bill's second career came as a well-liked and respected pre- and post-game television analyst, where on a nightly basis, Sox fans saw his passion for the team win or lose. Bill was a friend to many at the White Sox around baseball, and his booming voice will be missed. Our sympathies go out to his wife, Tess, and all of their family and friends. We echo that sentiment here at the White Sox Radio Network. You know, Carm and Yerk, our midday show on ESPN 1000, had a bit of a remembrance for Belton Bill on Thursday afternoon, and I encourage you to go back and listen to that. And, you know, when I started talking about Bill a little bit, I mentioned that I don't often do this, but I think in this case, an exception is not only understood but warranted and needs to be made. Chuck Garfine, who has been the White Sox pre- and post-game host on television for a good number of years and does a fantastic job, he's, you know, got a podcast with the new TV network CHSN, and he spent an entire episode talking about his, you know, love of, connection with, professional relationship with Bill. I highly encourage you to go listen to it. I think one of the things that Chuck does so incredibly well is blend his own emotion with the game of baseball and bring it to you in a way that makes things feel unvarnished and clear at the same time. And I think in that podcast, which I had a chance to listen to a little while ago, you really get a sense of who Bill was through kind of understanding who Chuck is. I highly recommend you going to listen to it if you're maybe if you're a younger fan and you didn't really know who Bill was. Maybe you saw him on TV a couple of times, you know, later on or whatever. It's a story that's worth knowing, and his baseball career is one worth knowing as well. I'll tell you a little bit of a story here about Bill Melton. On the last day in 1971, three guys, Norm Cash, Reggie Jackson, and Bill Melton, were all tied at 32 home runs. Melton had hit two home runs the day before to get himself into that three-way tie. Second last day of the year, Bill hits two homers. He's right there at 32 with Cash and Reggie Jackson. So on the last day of the season, and the White Sox would go 79-83 in that year. Last day of the season, Melton hits leadoff against the Brewers. He comes up to the plate for the second time, homers to left center, number 33, and that tied the franchise record at the time and won him the American League home run title. First White Sox player to win the AL home run title. The Sox won both of those last two games of the year. Both games finished 2-1, White Sox winners, and Melton had three of the four final RBI for that White Sox team. Such was, well, really, 1971, as many White Sox fans know, 71 was really a setup to that White Sox run of the early 70s. You know, Dick Allen comes on board in 1973, and under Chuck Tan, 1972, I think it's in 1973, 1972, and of course, you know, Chuck Tanner's got him playing well. Allen hits 37 home runs and wins his MVP award, 113 RBI, 99 walks. He had a 420 on base percentage. I guess I'm getting into the Dick Allen conversation here because we will talk a little bit about Dick Allen and his chances for the Hall of Fame coming up in just a couple of days. But anyway, you know, the White Sox, you know, with Bill Melton already on board, Carlos May is on that team. You know, you've got, you know, some established pitchers in Wilbur Wood and Tom Bradley. You've got a team. You've got a ball club here. Goose Gossage in his, what, age 19, age 20 season, you know, early on. You've got some real interesting pieces here in 1971 that lead to the White Sox signing Dick Allen in 1972, winning 87 games and finishing second in the American League West that year to the Oakland A's, who won 93 games. in 1973. Milton would come back, a nice bounce back season. More on that in just a second. But in 1973, the White Sox finished 77-85 again under Chuck Tanner as the manager there. And of course, Dick Allen had moved on. Melton back. You've got Jerry Hairston involved in that ball club. Carlos May still there. Wilbur Wood, of course, still pitching. And a guy you may have heard of, Steve Stone, joins that team and begins to pitch for the White Sox in 1973 after 2 years with the San Francisco Giants. Just a couple of different connections, both you know, on TV and as teammates, all that kind of stuff throughout the years. You know, the interesting thing about that 1972, and really somewhat unfortunate thing about that 1972 White Sox team, is the fact that in the offseason, Bill Melton hurt his back. He only played 57 games in 1972, and really that back injury would be something that affected him for the rest of his career. Not too many seasons after that. I believe he retired in 1976. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated in March of 73 with a good comeback campaign after injuring his back in 72. Melton hit .277 with an .802 OPS and hit himself 20 home runs as well. So a great comeback campaign. I promised you a little bit of Bill Melton, and I think you'll hear some of this in some other places along with, you know, some of the great analysis that he gave on the White Sox pre- and post-game show on television for the better part of for more than a decade. But this is post-game after the last game of the year in 1971. Remember, I told you Melton hit two home runs in the second-to-last day of the year and on the last day of the season. In his second at-bat, hit home run number 33 that gave him the American League title. Take a listen. Here is the post-game interview in all of its glory from 1971. Picture it. Melton in the red pinstripe jersey. He's got a 1970s crop of hair that can only, I mean, it is just screaming 70s. He looks fantastic. And here's the audio after the game, after Bill Melton hit number 33 to win the home run title.
Bill, when you came to the ballpark today, tied with Norm Cash and Reggie Jackson, how did you expect the Milwaukee pitchers to react? Did you think you would get anything good to hit?
No, I didn't, Brent. I didn't think I would at all. You know, it's kind of a funny feeling, you know. They knew I was going for the home run, and I hadn't hit Parsons well all year, and I didn't expect them to challenge me, but they did, and it's a good feeling.
You got a fastball up high, and you just rode it out of
here. It was a fastball down. They tried to get me up with a couple, you know, make me pop it up. I let them go, and like I said, I got a 2-2 fastball down, and I hit the ball well. I was very happy it wasn't a cheap home run. I don't think you can get a cheap one in this park.
Phil, most baseball players say they don't hit home runs when they try to, that they just come when they swing naturally, but yet you came here determined to try and win the championship outright. Then.
Right, that's the thing. For the last 2 weeks, I've been trying to hit the ball out of the park, and mainly just because I wanted a cushion. I wanted to get ahead by more than one, let's say two or three, but I wasn't successful. I told myself these last 2 days, I said, I'm going to have to go back to, I had to guess a pitch, and I had to guess a zone, and you know, there was nothing to do but hit home runs because basically I'm not going to hit three. I wasn't going for 300 or anything. I wanted the home run crown, and that's the first time I've ever hit three home runs and tried.
So again, you know, a sad week for the White Sox family, the franchise, and of course the Meltons. Our thoughts are with them. You know, Melton's connection to the franchise does not end. You know, when he stops playing, or even when he starts, you know, on television in 1992. Melton came back to Chicago as a team ambassador and part-time scout for the White Sox. He worked with Basketball Hall of Famer Michael Jordan following Jordan's first retirement from the NBA in 1993. He was one of his hitting instructors, and Melton told a great story to another guy up the dial. And I highly encourage you listening to that story as well. And about, you know, some of the work he was doing with Michael in the batting cages at the ballpark, you know, in the late 90s, and just what they were getting up to. In 1998, Melton joined the White Sox TV broadcast as a pre- and post-game analyst over on WGN, and then, of course, over to Comcast Sportsnet at NBC Sports Chicago until Melton retired in 2020. Bill Melton also served as head of the team's alumni relations in the early 2000s, and I didn't know that until I read the release. I didn't know that he had served in that function for the White Sox until I had read the release that announced his death from the White Sox. And after I read that, it's the second to last sentence of the news release from the White Sox. And I thought, well, that sounds about right. Head of team alumni relations, Melton bringing everybody back to the ballpark and keeping in touch with everybody, telling stories, shooting it. I mean, That really fits Bill Melton, a guy that I wish I knew better and thoroughly enjoyed talking baseball with every time I got a chance to do it. I would, when he was at the ballpark, I would do my best to go seek him out and make sure I got a little bit of Bill in my day, because it was just that much fun to talk baseball with him. He was always going to give you the truth. But then again, you're a White Sox fan, and you saw him on TV for about 15 years, and you know that Bill always told you the truth. Rest in peace to Bill Melton. Lot to talk about on the other side of the show. It starts with that and a remembrance and a celebration of Bill Melton, that's for sure. When we get back, we'll talk about some of the coaching staff news that we've got coming out here over the last couple of days. We'll talk about what's coming up in the winter meetings for the White Sox as well, perhaps a player or two or three or four, and the Rule 5 draft that might entice the White Sox in this new kooky rule, maybe called the golden at bat. That's being percolated all over the place. We'll get to it later. It's a lot of White Sox talk to come here on White Sox Weekly on ESPN.
This is Chicago's home for sports.
On app.
The ESPN Chicago app.
In HD.
FM 100.3 HD2.
And of course on AM.
ESPN 1000.
This is White Sox Weekly.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000. I'm Connor McKnight. Sox fans, now is your chance to meet with new White Sox manager Will Venable. Enter the Meet the Manager sweepstakes for your chance to win an exclusive meet and greet on January 23rd. To learn more and to enter, visit whitesox.com/meet the manager. Winter meetings coming up in, Sunday. They start tomorrow. There's obviously, you know, a lot of news been going on here over the last few days. Things have really started to heat up, and I'm really glad, you know, that this winter has at least started out a lot more active than last winter. You know, we had to wait and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait and wait for trades and free agents and all the other kind of stuff that we love over the course of the offseason. But just in the last couple of days, you know, Tampa Bay Rays signing catcher Danny Jansen. The Guardians are set to re-sign Shane Bieber. The Athletics gave a big deal to Luis Severino to, if not lead the rotation, then be certainly the number two guy there with a lot of money. It sounds like Matt Chapman might be moving to shortstop if the Giants sign Ha-Seong Kim. All kinds of different stuff and weird things going on, and I love it. I'm into it. A winter of news is much better than a winter of no news. And it sounds like when we get to the winter meetings starting tomorrow, even as we speak, we could have the biggest domino of them all, Juan Soto, all set and ready to go. And I would imagine that Scott Boras, super agent, though he is, or as he is, rather, we'll have a whole lot to talk about at his kind of, you know, state of the state address at the winter meetings, as he normally does. I want to take you through the timeline of the winter meetings here in just a little bit. But one of the things that we had kind of expected from the White Sox, and who knows, you know, maybe we get this in the next couple hours or whatever, but we only have it via reports right now. And big credit to Daryl Van Scowen of the Sun-Times, who had this reporting on, December 1st, which was, my gosh, what day is it now? Today's the 7th, so the 1st was last Sunday, right after we finished the show last week. But Daryl had reported, you know, kind of like we'd talked about a little bit, that, you know, the White Sox were expecting to bring back hitting coach Marcus Thames, pitching coach Ethan Katz. Grady Sizemore will be on the staff one way or another, not entirely sure how. But Daryl had that Justin Jerschle, longtime manager in the minor leagues for the White Sox, from Wisconsin, was going to be the third base coach for Will Venable. And first base coach Jason Bourgeois expected back as well. He runs the outfield. And then assistant pitching coach Matt Wise and Drew Butera, who is the catching coach, are all expected back. That's a big contingent of returning coaches for a team that is, you know, coming off of a season, the season the White Sox did with 121 losses. Walker McKinven, who we talked about a lot on, I want to say it was 2 weeks ago, his show 2 weeks ago, the bench coach leaving Milwaukee and coming over to the White Sox is, you know, a big change there, and a first-time bench coach for first-time manager Will Venable. But not a lot of other changes in and around the coaching staff, at least not yet. It's still entirely possible the White Sox expand the coaching staff some. But, you know, I think a lot of people thought, and maybe even some of the White Sox thought that they'd have this thing wrapped up. The coaching staff, like, officially announced at this point. There's no deadline for having done that. You've got your manager. You've got most of the pieces set. It's not like you have to make announcements or anything like that. But, you know, in looking back, and I understand the sentiment, right? You know, the season that was necessitated change, and some has been made. There are those who want a whole lot more. I would just say this. You had a front office in Chris Getz remake some of the inner workings, the off-the-field stuff that they do, right? Bringing in assistant managers, assistant general managers, as you say, guys like Brian Bannister, Ryan Fuller now in tow, a big change in this offseason. And given what last year was, right, a wholly disappointing and severely under-talented team that also didn't do the things it thought it could, I don't know that coaches are necessarily a source of blame one way or the other. And I think when you're talking about reworking things from the very top, right, with guys like Brian Bannister and Ryan Fuller being your pitching and offensive coordinators, essentially, right? I still haven't brought myself to call it a defensive and offensive coordinator like in football. I can't do it. It's pitching and offense. And I guess if you want to throw the coordinator on there, that's fine. But director of hitting and director of pitching, maybe that's just a better way to put it. Those are the titles that they've thrown on each guy. Anyway, I think that as long as, you know, from Getz on to Brian Bannister, on to Ryan Fuller, and down the organizational chart we go, as long as there's a mesh, then I'm cool with continuing to work this way. And obviously the White Sox are going to change, I think, a lot on the roster come 2025, start of the season in 2025. And that brings us to one quick piece of news that broke last night just after bedtime. Well, at least just after bedtime for two-year-olds. I know when that is. Anyway, I was still awake. The White Sox agreed to a minor league deal with free agent outfielder Calvin Mitchell. Arum Layton of Just Baseball did the first reporting there. This has not been confirmed by the team. This is just reports. But, you know, a minor league deal for a lefty bat, 25 years old, number 50 in the draft, the 50th overall pick in the draft of 2017. He was drafted by the Pirates last year with the Padres. Played pretty well at AAA. Had a 114 WRC+, way to runs created plus, batted 277, on base of 359, a 512 slugging percentage. It's the fourth year in a row that he's at least put some time in at Triple A. Hitting has gone well there for him. He has some splits platoon-wise, but started to even those out a little bit. In last season, 114 plate appearances against left-handers, and that's starting to go the other. Sorry, I said starting even out. What I meant was starting to bifurcate a little bit more. He is much a better hitter against righties than he is against lefties. The platoon splits are real. However, when you're looking at a guy that can play a little bit of left, a little bit of center, and be a left-handed bat, to mix in with the depth, Andrew Benintendi, Luis Robert Jr., Dominic Fletcher, Austin Slater, Oscar Colas, Corey Julks, and now Cal Mitchell with perhaps some more added here. I doubt in the Rule 5 draft. We'll get to that in a second. You know, you're starting to see kind of the outfield mix come together just a little bit. And, you know, like we always talk about here on the show and throughout the season, the 26 you break camp with is never, ever the 26 you end the season with. You need a whole lot of depth. And the White Sox, of course, if the season goes the way that the front office would prefer it to, given the expectations, you know, you've got guys performing well and probably being featured in trade conversations come June, July, and prospects coming back to the White Sox to enforce the chance of winning in the near and long-term future, both. So just kind of the news and notes there, according to the coaching staff and that minor league signing that happened last night. Now, when it comes to the winter meetings on Sunday, there's kind of a schedule of events, a couple of things going on here that the White Sox could feature in, if not fairly prominently, then, you know, certainly some things that will matter, right? Winter meetings start tomorrow. The draft lottery is on Tuesday night. The White Sox cannot pick higher than 10th. We talked about that a lot all throughout the season last year. Now, the Rule 5 draft is Wednesday at 1 p.m. Central Time. I had to do the conversion from Eastern to Central in my head, and that's not an easy thing for me to do. The White Sox do have the first pick in the Rule 5 draft, and you'll remember that the White Sox took Shane Drohan, a lefty, from the Boston Red Sox last year. He got hurt and did not play for the White Sox last season. The White Sox have made a couple of Rule 5 selections over the last few years. Some have gotten hurt, some returned, some have played a little bit. The Rule 5 draft, and J.J. Cooper of Baseball America does an amazing job covering not just the players that are going to be featured here in the Rule 5 draft and kind of the scouting reports. And he's just a real big fan of the whole event for whatever reason. And I am too, especially for teams in the situation that the White Sox find themselves in, right? Rebuilding teams. However, with the and Cooper was writing about this a little bit at Baseball America, and I'd been thinking along the same lines, but Cooper's much smarter and was able to draw that together a little bit quicker. With the deletion of a good number of minor league teams over the last few years, right, and the elimination of rookie ball as it was and a whole level of minor league baseball, that means that the players and the rosters have been condensed in a lot of different – in every space in minor league baseball. Which also means that the number of players available to each team, you know, like within their organization, is fewer, which means that the number of potential prospects that you feel you need to commit to the 40-man roster are fewer, which means that the guys that squeezed out are fewer, which means that the guys there in the Rule 5 draft just aren't quite as exciting as perhaps they used to be. Now, Cooper goes on to, and I recommend the article, goes on to talk about some of the ways you could kind of ameliorate some of these issues as it pertains to the Rule 5 draft. But I, you know, I'm a minor league enthusiast. I really do like the development that the Major League Baseball used to have, right? The multiple levels. And I think we are missing something there now that those levels aren't here. You know, you got to move forward. And I think instead of, you know, maybe sitting down and talking about the guys that the White Sox could add in the Rule 5 draft, which we will, I think kind of important to focus on is some of the guys the White Sox did leave off the roster or off the 40-man roster and might be interesting to other teams. Now, as is often the case, the Rule 5 draft is going to be primarily composed of pitchers. It's just easier, especially relievers, you know, to stash a guy on the roster for the entire year. Remember, you get taken into the Rule 5 draft. The team's got to keep you on the big league roster for the entire season or the big league injured list. Otherwise, they have to offer you back to the team from which they drafted you for a nominal fee. I think it's $50,000 or $100,000, something like that. Money doesn't really matter in this. What it's easy to do, like I said, is kind of stash a pitcher, right? You could often see a guy, especially with a 13-man bullpen, a guy at the back end who pitches in, you know, mop-up duty or you know, 10-run deficits, and you're being that guy and kind of seeing what you can work on. We've seen that before. So those guys are featured, and to that end, the White Sox have two, Anthony Huopi Tuiantotoa and Trey Magoe, both of whom they acquired in trades last year. Huopi Tuiantotoa was in return for Robbie Grossman, and Trey Magoe came back in the deal that sent Eloy Jimenez to the Baltimore Orioles. Those guys are, you know, they're relievers who seem pretty close to being ready, and if another team wanted to snag either one of those arms and throw them into the mix, I wouldn't be too surprised. Now, the White Sox did protect Juan Corella. He's a guy the White Sox got back in the deal for Keenan Middleton to the Yankees 2 years ago. He'd pitched pretty well down there in the minor leagues, and you would expect him. I would think Juan Corella's going to get big league time at some point this season, if not break camp with the team. But I would think – oh, and the other guy, Wilfred Veras, another guy that you know, the guys over at Future Sox and other big-time prospect writers have kind of taken a look at. Veras, as a position player and kind of a defensive wanderer a little bit, certainly some pop in the bat. You could see it. It's just really hard. And this is kind of what I'm talking about what the White Sox could add, too. It's just hard to find the roster space. The hitters are going to be protected on this 40-man roster. I mean, that's essentially what it is. You saw the White Sox do it with Colson Montgomery. That's a little bit different. Montgomery could start the season at the bigs, but it's just, you know, it's a guy you know you're not going to move anywhere because we all understand the value of position players on, you know, rookie deals, essentially, in their first 3 years of Major League Baseball. It's just a very difficult thing to do, to carry a guy that's going to still be developing at the plate. You can work with that on the mound because it is so hard to hit, but because it's so hard to hit, that's an entirely different thing to do at a big league level. And for that reason, I would expect, though there are a couple of guys eligible in the Rule 5 draft that do seem to be, you know, maybe ready to compete at the big league level, I would expect the White Sox to go with an arm, maybe some of, you know, the harder throwers, maybe a guy that's more command and control, too. There are, kind of pick your poison here. And I was looking through, some of the potential ads in the Rule 5 draft that the other teams have left exposed to the draft. I was looking for guys that kind of fit the Brian Bannister mold, right? Kind of like a funkier delivery or something odd about him. And it's tough to find that guy necessarily. Logan Workman, a right-hander for the Rays, threw a lot in AA and AAA this last year, a 2.71 ERA in 123 innings, and then got bumped up to AAA Durham. 25 years old, four pitches. Injuries have been the issue there for the 25-year-old Logan Workman. Ryan Webb, a left-hander in the Guardians, was like the more command and control kind of guy, a finesse sort of dude. Again, four pitches, and he's dropped his walk rate a little bit from 2023 to 2024. Still a lot of walks, however. This is what you're going to see. Shane Smith of the Brewers, a 24-year-old, short reliever for the most part in 2023, stretched things out a little bit as kind of like a swing guy, long guy, multiple inning guy last year, and that's starting to be much more appealing for teams. When he's gone shorter, he can get the fastball velocity way up there, close to 100, and can sit something like 92, 94. And I really like the idea of a pitcher that understands how to do that with his velocities to be a bit more of a versatile approach kind of guy that can soak up some innings and give you perhaps some high leverage as well. I love the idea of being able to have one guy kind of be two different roster solutions for you as well. Griff McGarry, another guy, a former top prospect in the Phillies organization. Walks are a huge issue. Strikeouts are almost automatic for him. Huge number of strikeouts, 296 strikeouts in 203 innings just last year. But, you know, it's a lot of walks, 6.8 walks per nine for Griff McGarry out of the Phillies organization. So I think an arm's going to go. You know, the White Sox could keep drafting too, but, you know, again, if they take him, they've got to keep him on the big league roster for the entire season or offer him back to the team from which they drafted him. So it is kind of a dicey proposition, but, you know, the arms are where the White Sox have some room to play. The position spots do, and it's weird, do kind of feel locked up, at least to start the year. You've got guys that you want to offer spots to in Brooks Baldwin and Brian Ramos and Miguel Vargas and Colson Montgomery, perhaps. The list goes on a little bit longer, but not much. And that's about all the spots you've got, or at least defensive spots you've got, in order to put the lineup together. When we come back, a lot more here on White Sox Weekly. We'll get into some Hall of Fame chances for former White Sox as well before we're out of here. I'm Connor McKnight. You got ESPN 1000.
We are talking White Sox.
This is White Sox Weekly.
If you missed the show, we put the podcast up on the ESPN Chicago app. So listen on your time.
White Sox Weekly. ESPN Chicago. Chicago's home for sports.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. Sox fans, find the perfect gift for everyone on your list this holiday season with the White Sox Holiday Gift Guide. Shop holiday flex packs, 2025 ticket plans, and more. Shop now at whitesox.com/giftguide. Well, one of the gifts that is apparently not coming to pass in the next season, or hopefully any of the following seasons, I'm probably leaning a little bit too heavily on this after all. The idea of a Major League Baseball commissioner, or at least the part of the job description, I think should be moving the game in new directions. And that is something that Rob Manfred, to his credit, has done here over the last couple of years. The pitch clock has been fantastic. The running game adjustments last year, I thought, helped out a lot. I do not care for the zombie runner rule in the 10th inning. That has been, we've made that clear over the last couple of seasons. I mean, I got it in 2020. That was weird. Whole thing. Anything to get baseball back on was great with me, but I wish it would just go away. That said, not every idea is going to be a winner, right? I get that. It's just part of the business. Rob Manfred earlier this week addressed the idea, or brought up the idea, or floated a trial balloon of an idea for the golden at bat rule. And yeah, I get it. Before you hop on, over the last 24 hours, 36 hours, really, Manfred has begun to talk in other places. I think an interview on the Yes Network Thursday night, I believe it was, where Manfred was talking about how, hey, listen, it's a long time away. It's just something we're talking about. I'm kicking it around. And if you don't like the idea, I think the quote was, I wouldn't be concerned about it right now. This happens more often than not. The tri balloon did what it needed to do. He brought up the idea earlier in the week. It got shot down by a lot of different people and places and smart thinkers in the game. And, I think that was the right kind of response to the idea. But in case you missed the idea of the golden at bat, it was essentially this, and there were some tweaks, and Jesse Rogers, our very own, did some reporting about it. And I would encourage you to go read it because, we'll get to that in a second. I mean, read Jesse Rogers' stuff always. That's kind of a blanket statement here on White Sox Weekly, but I'll get to the idea behind that in just a second. The idea would be that at some point, once during a game, you could send up a designated guy, right? One hitter to be your golden at bat guy. He could come back into the game, right? So if you're the Dodgers and Shohei Ohtani comes up to bat or is going to come up to bat next, but right now you've got your light hitting nine hitter, maybe Shohei Ohtani's. Is there a light hitter in the Dodgers lineup anymore? I don't think there really is. Anyway, bases loaded, one away, Ohtani's on deck. You could just make, if he's your golden batter, right? He could go in there, take his first cuts, and then maybe take his next, take two consecutive at-bats, or maybe you'd tweak the rules so that you couldn't do that. Maybe there'd be a lot of tweaks to be involved, but you could use that one guy, that super player, to come back in and hit twice, once in a game. It got met with the kind of response that I think it should have been met with, some pretty heavy-duty skepticism, cynicism in some places. Enough people were intrigued a little bit about it to start thinking about what the gamification might be around this rule, or how teams might use it. At the end of the day, we are seeing a stratification in baseball, salary-wise, from the top-tier players, top-tier teams, all this other kind of stuff. And I find it to be, obviously inequity is part of competition, right? Some teams are better, some teams are worse, some teams have higher payrolls, some teams have lower payrolls, all that kind of stuff. But the idea is in baseball that if you build a team the right way, and that's not to say the Cardinals or whatever, it's not the right way. But if you build a good team, you can do that for in a competitive environment. You can do that for less than whatever the Dodgers are going to end up paying their major league roster this year, whatever the Yankees are going to end up paying their roster in the coming season. You can still compete. Yet this golden at bat rule continues to lean on the best of the best. And I think spreading things out a little bit, even though it might be, I'm not talking about pitchers hitting again. I'm just talking about the guys in the lineup continuing to hit and do their jobs. Different size players, different shapes of swings and approaches and all this other kind of stuff. You can win in a lot of different ways in baseball. You don't have to continue to pound the ball out of the ballpark, though I do find that to be a pretty effective way of winning and one I champion. I don't know. It struck me weird. It just did. I didn't like the idea of losing this, starting nine. The designated hitter has made enough changes to it. You could, after all, pinch hit. You could employ better pinch hitters, better bench players. If you are a championship type team, maybe take that next step and sign that next best player, a guy that could be a starter somewhere else, pay him properly, get him on your bench and have him be the guy to take that at bat if you absolutely have to pinch hit, get your platoon advantage or whatever. Didn't care for the golden at bat rule, and I am I'm pretty glad that it's going to be mothballed at least for a while. All that said, I do like the idea of this, whatever you want to call it, regime of Major League Baseball, the Rob Manfred commissionership, of kind of pushing the envelope of some of the rules here. I like that he at least doesn't seem worried about floating a bad idea to get people talking about what this game needs to turn into in the future or could turn into in the future, right? And I mean that in two different ways, because I think the game really did need to get shorter. I think it needed that in a very big way. What it could become is another conversation altogether. And I think when it comes to the on-field product, we are getting closer and closer to a kind of baseball that is more broadly appealing to audiences of all different age groups. And I think that in, you know, continuing to push that envelope, we begin to open baseball back up. We had huge ratings for the playoffs in the World Series last year. And of course, it's New York and LA, but those are numbers and those are people and they're watching, and you can get those numbers or at least some of them back for more of the regular season if you've got the product that was on display in the World Series. Okay, so how do we get there? Well, perhaps that's a way to maybe reverse engineer some of the rest of the game. And, you know, make no mistake, in the winter meetings, you know, we're going to be talking about Juan Soto and what the White Sox are going to do and, you know, what any other team is going to end up doing and what free agents and trades and all this other kind of stuff. But a big point of the conversation is going to be what's next on the TV front for Major League Baseball. And while the game is concerned with its future on television and financial security, which are both two very similar things, almost the same thing, we don't get to maybe perhaps also alter the game a little bit, tweak where it needs tweaking and stuff like that. I think we are kind of hamstrung a little bit by the state of those finances. And yeah, I guess maybe it's just Pollyanna-ish, but I do hope that that, you know, future gets resolved or settled sooner rather than later, because like everybody, I do not want to see that come to a head for next CBA. I want baseball. I don't want negotiations, that's for sure. We've got some Hall of Fame conversation when we come back. We'll talk a little bit about the ballot and one guy who's not on the ballot and should have been in a long time ago and is up for a veterans vote. Of course, we're talking about Dick Allen, and he should be in the Hall of Fame. Back with more on ESPN 1000.
This is Chicago's home for sports.
On app.
The ESPN Chicago app.
In HD.
FM 100.3 HD2.
And of course on AM.
ESPN 1000.
This is White Sox Weekly.
Closing it up here on White Sox Weekly, but not before we talk about the Hall of Fame chances of Dick Allen. And we'll find out Sunday whether or not the Veterans Committee, is the classic baseball era committee, is going to put Dick Allen in the Hall of Fame. He has been close the last couple of years, one vote short. The panel this year of voters consists of Hall of Famers Ozzie Smith, Lee Smith, Paul Molitor, Eddie Murray, Joe Torre, and Tony Perez. Executives like Sandy Alderson, Terry McGurk, Dayton Moore, Artie Moreno, Brian Sabian, and some media members, Bob Elliott, Leslie Heafy, Steve Hurt, Dick Cagle, and Larry Lester. I am hoping, very, very much hoping, that Dick Allen makes the Hall of Fame. He should have been in a long time ago. He died in 2020, and a lot thought that, you know, cynical as it is, often that happens, and a player has been held out for so long, makes it the next season. I think Allen, there are a lot of others who follow this, you know, the year-to-year, you know, kind of assemblage of this committee much more closely, and it seems like it's close. Allen, one of the first assignments I had when I came to town and began working in media after, you know, growing up in this area and coming back, was, you know, kind of learn about the team I was covering a little bit, the eras that I lost. And when I took my seat in the White Sox press box in, what was it, 2009 or something like that, I had to walk by the Sports Illustrated cover, you know, the one that has Dick Allen on the cover, cigarette hanging out of his mouth and juggling a baseball. One is MVP, one is his only MVP in 1972 with the White Sox, hitting 37 home runs and 113 RBI. My God, he was just fantastic. And as I walked by that Sports Illustrated cover, I didn't know about him because it was 1972 when he won the award, and I wasn't around then and wasn't really looking back to the history quite yet. And as I did, and as I looked at the numbers and kind of the context of Dick Allen's career, I thought, my God, how is he not in the Hall of Fame? And I'm really hoping that that whole thing ends in just a short amount of time, in about 24 hours or so. Dave Parker, Vic Harris, John Donaldson, all up for Hall of Fame votes in the Baseball Classic Era Committee. Louis Tiant, Steve Garvey, Tommy John. There's a White Sox connection for you as well. Ken Boyer. There's eight total on the ballot this year. And if you haven't yet, I highly recommend The Writing of One James Fegan of SoxMachine.com. I did not know the story of John Donaldson until I'd read it, written by Fegan on that website. Donaldson was a White Sox scout, the first black White Sox scout in the organization. I will let James tell you the rest of the story, and you should read it. It is absolutely fantastic. He was one of the best pitchers in baseball in the Negro Leagues and pre-Negro Leagues. Did a lot of barnstorming, did John Donaldson. And some of the stories about what he was able to do on the field and off the field, pushing for integration prior to Jackie Robinson, much prior to Jackie Robinson. And there were a lot of efforts. James does a great job of relating this in his piece as well. So many efforts to integrate the game well before Jackie Robinson did. And Donaldson was a key driver of some of those efforts, and especially in pushing some of the scouting of young black kids in African-American, predominantly African-American schools, high schools, you know, scouting those areas, bringing those players into baseball. It's an incredible story, and James did a heck of a job writing it up on SoxMachine.com. Go take a read, and hopefully Donaldson and the rest, Dick Allen and company, get into the Hall of Fame in just a little bit. That's going to do it for our show. Appreciate you listening. We'll be back next Saturday for more White Sox Weekly here on ESPN 1000.